right.
Delight.
If you'll start over, Dr. Jacobs.
Certainly.
Thank
certainly.
You.
Co-Chair Berger and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I am the administrator for the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, State Public Health Division, Department of Human Services. And I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 162, which is the department's bill supported by the governor's office, which we hope will lead to major improvements for emergency medical services and trauma services across the state of Oregon. And the first thing I'm going to do is start with an apology. Usually when I provide testimony, I try to keep it to one page, and I try to keep my comments to less than 5 minutes. And today, because of the scope of this bill for us, I have 5 pages worth of testimony, and I think it's going to take me about 15 minutes to get through this. One of the 4 major programs in my office is emergency medical services and trauma systems. We license ambulances and ambulance services, over 600 ambulances in Oregon. We certify over 9,000 EMTs and first responders. We discipline when there are complaints or problems with any of those facilities, ambulances, or professionals. We also, though, do more than just regulation. We have a training function and actually have 2 mobile training units that are out in the field providing education and training to first responders and EMTs across the state. And we also manage and administer the trauma system, which is a voluntary program of 45 hospitals across the state who work to make sure that seriously injured people are transported to a facility where they can be cared for appropriately. And the trauma system and the EMS program really has had a proud past. 15 years ago, the National Highway and Traffic and Safety Administration came out and did an assessment of our emergency medical services and trauma systems here in Oregon. And what they found in that time was a model program that the rest of the country should be emulating. A decade and a half later, we've seen serious erosion of resources at both the state and the local level. Because we had some concerns about our program, we asked NHTSA to come out again and do an assessment, which they did, and this time the results were very different. They said that Oregon has really lost ground, that we now need to do a lot of catching up simply to get back to the norm that we see across the country. They said what we're seeing now is a fragmented, variable non-system. We're seeing great maldistribution of resources across the state, with rural and frontier areas being hit the hardest. And they made it clear that they're not trying to comment on bad care. In fact, they complimented the people who are out in the field providing services on the street and at the scene. They said that they're doing a very good job. Their main issue was that there just has not been the kind of leadership at the state level to ensure that there's good systems and coordinated systems of care across the state. So it was hard to hear this, but we knew we had some problems, and we wanted to use whatever that report was as a roadmap for where we were headed. And so what we did then is pull together what we called the Oregon Advisory Team, and this was a group of about 20 people that we thought were experts in EMS and trauma across Oregon to take a look at that report. They said we agree with many of the things that the NHTSA reassessment has said. Instead of going item by item through the 66 recommendations in 11 program areas, they instead said, we think that you need to focus on 5 key areas. The first is vision and leadership. We need to be working on the development of systems. We need to have a comprehensive plan, and it's really the state EMS and trauma system program that needs to step up and do that. The second issue is one of governance. They said there really seems to be a disconnect between the providers and the public we serve and the actual program at the state level. And what we need to do is ensure that the advisory committees that we have are not only providing good input that the program listens to, but also are providing coordinated input. A third area is in the area of medical direction. The program has actually never had a medical director. I've been responsible for the program for the last year. Last time I did an ambulance run or ER work was in 1979, and I'm the closest that the program's ever had to actual medical direction. So one of the comments was we need to have a medical director in that program who's not going to provide state-level mandates that are onerous responsibilities on the locals, but instead what we need to do is make sure that that person provides support to the local EMS medical directors and those agencies. The fourth issue dealt with evaluation and quality improvement. They said we need to have a comprehensive, robust data system, which we simply do not have right now. We're pretty good on the trauma side, but on the pre-hospital side with ambulances, on the medical hospital side, they said we really do not have the data that you need, and the reason we need that data is to drive quality improvement processes. And then the fifth and final area that they mentioned was preparedness, that we need to have better linkages at both the state and local level with what's going on with the Office of Emergency Management, local emergency managers, and what we're doing in the public health side of things as well. And in particular, they said one thing you need to do is to have a strike team approach so that similar to what we got, what the governor can currently do with fire, that the governor could do with EMS and ambulance services as well. So that was the report that came back from the advisory team, and what we did then is worked with legislative council to come up with a draft bill. When that came out as Senate Bill 162, we then started working with our partners. Actually, we had been working with our partners all along, but we worked with our state trauma advisory board, the state EMS committee, the Oregon Fire Medical Association, the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, Oregon State Ambulance Association, Hospital Association, the OMA, and others, to try to craft the bill, recraft the bill, so it's something that we could all work with, and that would be the best bill that we could get. And actually, on February 22nd, we again convened a group of 22 stakeholders where we went over Senate Bill 162 and came up with 19 pages of potential amendments. So rather than having those 19 pages and have two documents to work from, we had our Assistant Attorney General craft what you're had passed out to you today. It's a document that says Senate Bill 162, proposed DHS amendments. And this is the bill that, quote bill, that we are now working from. This is what would look like an engrossed version of Senate Bill 162, but we can't call it engrossed because it has not gone through legislative council yet. It's just what we got back from our council. So this is the bill that we are now working on. We still think that there's more that needs to be done, but we continue to work with our stakeholders and partners to, as I said, try to craft the best bill that we can. So if you take a look at this bill, and actually I also provided a two-pager that says description of Senate Bill 162 with DHS amendments, this goes section by section into what we're trying to accomplish here. And Section 2 that starts on page 1, line 33, rewrites the general duties and requires a comprehensive state plan, requires us to really focus on systems approach. And I use the word systems a lot. And just to try to clarify what I'm talking about, I want to tell you about a program right now that's going on in Southern Oregon. There's a particular kind of heart attack called an ST elevation myocardial infarction, and that kind of heart attack can be picked up on a 12-lead cardiogram when the person gets into an ambulance. And what they've done in Southern Oregon voluntarily is all of the hospitals, the seven hospitals, and all of the local ambulance agencies have said whenever we have one of those STEMI patients, we're not taking it to the local hospital, we're taking it to Rogue Valley Medical Center. And when it gets to Rogue Valley, we're not going to go to the emergency room, we're going to bypass the emergency room and go immediately to cardiac catheterization lab where a person can get diagnosed positively and a stent put in to prevent death or further morbidity. And the results that they've found in that program are absolutely astounding to me when you compare it to the results that you're seeing across the nation. That's the kind of thing that we would like to be able to do systems-wide across the state of Oregon. It's not a cookie-cutter approach saying everyone has to do it this way, but I would like to go to Northeast Oregon and say the outcome we want is to get people to a cath lab as quickly as possible when they've had a STEMI. How are you as a region going to do that and provide the technical resources to them to help them develop that kind of system? So when I talk about systems, that's what I'm talking about, and that really is what we're trying to do with Section 1, Section 2. There was some concern that this was too broadly written at first, and one of the major amendments we did in the rewrite was to try to narrow the authorities there. Also addressed in Section 2 is the EMS Medical Director position. That's in subsection 5 on page 3, line 36. Governance is actually addressed in a couple of areas, and as I mentioned, there were two problems with governance that people said. One was that we really don't have enough real solid work for our three existing advisory committees to do, and so these sections put in some real responsibilities for those committees. The other concern that we saw from NHTSA and from the advisory team was that there was a lack of coordination between those three committees, and so we've created a state coordinating council to ensure that the voice we get from those three committees really is high-level coordinated policy advice. There was some concern in the first draft that there was too much responsibility given to that coordinating council, and so we have changed that, and I think it's better for that change. The other issue on governance starts on in section 15 to 18, which is page 13, and this creates a board of medical emergency medical responders. And up until now, there really has not been a board structure, a peer board structure for emergency medical technicians and first responders. I basically, as the acting EMS director, serve as the board, and we think it is much more appropriate for there to be a peer board that is making those decisions about certification qualifications, about the development of rules, and about disciplinary actions. And to try to keep the costs down, what we have done here is said that the EMS director will be the executive director for the board of emergency medical responders, and staff will provide the staff support that is needed for that board. Evaluation and quality improvement is addressed in sections 10 and 11, and that starts on page 10, line 40. And as I mentioned, this mandates a comprehensive reporting and data management system. It is enhancing what we currently have on the data side, really requiring us to make sure we have the same kind of thing in pre-hospital care and on medical critical illnesses as well. And the importance here is to make sure that those data are not only collected, but they're analyzed, they're given back to the local agency so they can use them as they need to for quality improvement, and so that we as a state level, working with our advisory committees, can use it for quality improvement as well. Also in that section, it does deal with the confidentiality of the data, and also that legitimate researchers should have access to those data as well, as long as they maintain the confidentiality provisions. And then the final major section there are sections 39 through 46 that start on page 35. And this is where we create the EMS strike team capability. And with the declared emergency, if the governor needed to, the governor would be able to deploy both EMTs, first responders, and ambulance resources to places across the state where those services and resources are needed. This is really modeled after the Conflagration Act that we currently have for fire, and the issues of payment for those services and liability issues are covered. And I'll close then by saying that none of this could be done. I mean, there's enough in here that we simply could not take on these new responsibilities without getting new resources. And in the governor's recommended budget, there is a $2.2 million package. That package was primarily to be funded by the governor's proposed increase in tobacco tax, which I know right now is in question. But the $2.2 million package is in the governor's recommended budget, and we continue to work with our stakeholders to make sure that we will craft the best bill that we have, but also work with them on budget issues to make sure that we're getting the most out of these dollars and that it is very beneficial for people at the local level. And just some of the things that we're planning on doing with the budget. it is getting another mobile training unit out into the field, hiring a training coordinator to focus on distant learning solutions. We'd like to arrange for billing services so that we're making sure that those small agencies that do not feel they can bill right now do start billing so that we can get as much as possible out of insurance, Medicare, and Medicaid. We want to replicate across the state programs, like I mentioned, that we're currently seeing in Southern Oregon. We want to create that data management system and allow agencies and help agencies work with their own data around quality improvement activities. To help them get there, we want to purchase equipment so that it's easier for them to input information. We want to provide technical assistance around recruitment and intention, and we want to make sure that there's enough basic compliance staff around so that we can quickly follow up any certification questions or complaint investigations. So in summary, again, this is a major bill for us. We think that it will go a long way in improving state emergency medical services and trauma systems. But I thank you very much for paying attention and for being interested in this bill. I know that a number of you have a personal interest in these kind of issues. I know that Representative Boone is actually in the EMT first responder system, and appreciate all of your interest. And I also appreciate the partners, and I think several of them will come up and talk today. I think we've had really good response in trying to work together to make this the best bill that we have, and we're committed to continuing to do that throughout this session to try to get something passed that will really benefit the people of Oregon. And with that, I'll close.
Thank you, Dr. Higginson. We do have a number of people who want to speak, but I want you to clarify just a couple of things. One, on the systems, which is in the first sections there, in Section 2, there was a NPR story today on the number of hospitals that do not have anything for you if you go in. There's no staff there on the weekends if you were to have a heart attack. So if the ambulance service knows that, they would know which hospitals would be. So I have more specific on the data. Would that be the kind of thing that would be in this data bank?
Co-Chair Berger, that not necessarily in the data bank, because that's something that we'd need to know on a real-time basis, but clearly in the development of systems, like what we have right now for the trauma system, is that people know where they're supposed to go if they have a seriously injured person. If that hospital is full or if that hospital is understaffed, they notify the other hospitals in the regional system to let them know that they can't come to the hospital and need to go somewhere else. And that's so if that would be exactly the kind of things in developing a heart system that we would need to know which hospitals are not accepting heart patients or STEMI patients so that they would avoid going to that hospital.
The story went quite forward. It said if you have a history of heart conditions in your family, or if you've had small episodes, that you should find the hospital in your area so you would know where to go. So I presume it's a serious problem. So, all right, I'm going to move on Ken.
Thank you, Chair Berger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ken Murphy, the Director of Oregon Emergency Management. And I'm here to testify in support of this. I'll make up for Grant to Dr. Higginson taking so long, because I'm not an EMT or an expert, but I've had the pleasure of being Dr. Higginson's partner for many years on many things, to include this report that did come out from the National Highway Safety Transportation folks, and it was pretty hard to accept even when I read it, and not being an EMT, it was pretty frank and candid. And I think what this particular piece of legislation does is, you know, as Dr. Higginson explained, it really sets some framework to put the system back in place, give it some more framework and rules and things that will help all of the EMTs and the hospitals and the ambulance systems in Oregon. And I think it, to me, it's part of that an overall investment in how we prepare Oregon for all disasters. We're talking about the EMS and trauma system, and this is one of those pieces of that larger puzzle that I know this committee has heard on many different issues. And I just want to highlight one of the things I think is really important in this is Dr. Higgins explained how they could use this like the fire service with the conflagration where you bring to bear all the resources to one area if it's needed. And I think that's a great tool to help the citizens and visitors to this state. So I just want to pass on my support of this, and I think it's the right thing to do and to make our system better.
All right. I'm going to allow a few questions, and then we'll move on. Representative Nelson is first, and then Representative Shawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for being here. Dr. Higginson, I guess I'm in shock hearing this story today because I would have never ever even thought about the state being responsible for these services. And where I'm coming from is having started Evergreen Lifeline, the Medevac company, working with all the trauma centers here across the nation. You know, our concern was, you know, with the communities we served, the hospitals we used, of course, you know, which was in the best interest of the patient. So I guess I'm just wondering, the purpose of this is what? In case of a major emergency like a tsunami, what will be done? Or are we going to be telling, you know, the helicopter company, the ambulance companies, the fire departments what to do in the state now?
Co-Chair Berger and Representative Nelson, this of course would be important if there was a major disaster or an emergency, but it is equally, if not important, for day-to-day operations. And again, I go back to the systems approach for trauma. We have and it's a voluntary system of 45 hospitals that they choose what level they are going to participate at. And with that system and working with those providers, we're able to make sure that the people that are seriously injured get transported to the correct facility so they get the definitive care most quickly. And that's what we're trying to do, not only for trauma, but for other medical issues and for pediatric emergencies as well. And without this bill, we would not be able to do that. So that is one piece. Another piece is that we need to have data and use those data for quality improvement activities. We need to have a medical director to provide support for both our staff at the state level and also local agencies and local supervising physicians. So it does a number of things. We are not trying to create this so that we're putting onerous new burdens on people. As much as possible, we want this to be a voluntary system, but we want to provide incentives so that we really have coordinated systems of care for people when they're injured or ill.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. Doctor, I guess I'm wanting to know, who are you going to be directing your emergency management program? Are you going to be directing Evergreen Helicopters and where they take their patients?
Co-Chair Verger and Representative Nelson, no, we will not directly be directing them. And the way it works in trauma right now, there are seven area trauma advisory boards, and those advisory boards determine voluntarily amongst themselves what the transport patterns are going to be, and we would be using similar approaches for other kinds of care as well.
Well, I just want to follow up because I want to clarify this if I could. I know the trauma system. I know it very well. What I'm trying to decide is you recently, previously, I guess, said y'all are going to determine which hospitals best serve heart patients and whether Emanuel's a burn center, or, you know. And then what? Direct ambulances and medics and private companies where to take patients?
Co-Chair Verger and Representative Nelson, the way it's worked in Southern Oregon for the ST elevation myocardial infarction patient is that, again, it's a voluntary system where the seven hospitals together said this is the best way that we can provide care. the ambulance services said, we'll buy into that and we'll bypass the first hospital and take people to Rogue Valley, bypass the emergency department and take them right into the catheterization lab. They decided that on a voluntary basis. That's the only place that I know of in the state of Oregon right now that has that kind of coordinated system. I personally feel it's a state-level responsibility to try to get those kind of things going in other parts of the state as well. And as I said, I don't see us going out to a region and saying, this is how you're going to do it. I see us going out and say, this is the outcome that we want to see. How can you as a region work together to get that outcome? And that we would be able to provide state-level resources to actually help them do that.
No, the doctors answered my questions. Okay. I don't have the benefit of all the House members. I'm the only one that has not been involved in emergency response. So it's kind of speaking, this is, goes underneath the heading of, if they tell me so, I'm for it. So thank you very much for your patience.
We'll help you out.
Yeah, thank you. Believe me.
That's
a lot.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Hi, Dave.
Okay, Rick Nelson. I'll just, if it's okay, Madam Chair and Dr. Higginson, just schedule an appointment because I'm just in shock today. And I just wanted to understand how the state is going to direct private enterprise, you know, to participate the way it wants. Portland's pretty darn good, I will tell you, when they identify all their hospitals as far as, you know, patient care, so we knew where to take them. But we also understood that if you could get a trauma patient to a trauma center, you know, within an hour, we learned that out of the Vietnam War, within an hour, the odds went from 16 to 1 to 80 to 1, we could save his life. So it might not be the best hospital for heart, but it might be the best place that patient could be stabilized. So I'm just curious, when we start talking about we're going to direct from the state, I'm just concerned that I don't think we have that right.
And Co-Chair Berger and Representative Nelson, and again, I don't see this as directing. I see this as identifying best practices. I see this as incentivizing and facilitating and coordinating so that regions and localities can make these decisions for themselves. That's what I see our role, not as saying, this is the way you have to do it, and if you don't do it, you get penalized. I mean, we're not going to get anywhere that way, and I don't think that's the best way to serve the people of Oregon. And we actually did have an appointment set up a week or so ago, and it had to be canceled, and I would be happy to set up another follow-up appointment with you.
Great. Well, thank you
and
very much.
Just in closing, I want to say that the OMA was not able to be here today, but they have some written testimony and support, and I will give that. And then we also have some letters from our advisory committees that I'll get to the committee as well. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. Next, we'll call Ken Parsons from Mercy Flights in Medford, Sean Baird, Woodburn Ambulance, and Denise Giard from Albany. Did I say that right? Okay. Mm-hmm. Welcome. Mm-hmm.
Do you want to go first, dude? Thank you, Madam Chairs and committee members. My name is Ken Parsons. I'm the president of the Oregon State Ambulance Association. I'm also the general manager for Mercy Flights located in Medford, Oregon, and happen to be the largest pre-hospital provider in that STEMI protocol that Grant was bragging about. So that was nice of him to tell me how good a job we're doing. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you on the concerns of the Oregon State Ambulance Association on Senate Bill 162. And my comments are addressed towards the amended version that Dr. Higginson has handed out because we're part of that committee that has been working on refining the bill, so to speak. As you're aware, Senate Bill 162 was drafted in response to the NHTSA, National Highway Safety Traffic Administration's survey, and there's been other components of that added in there as a result of the committee meetings going over that process. One of our concerns is that survey addressed mostly the system organization and the state office. It had very little to do with the pre-hospital providers or the in-field care of that. And it addresses the health of the state's regulatory and supervisory function, not the health of the pre-hospital care providers. We do appreciate Dr. Higginson and the Health Division and their openness and willingness to work with all the providers to refine the bill and try and make sure that we get a reasonable solution to the issues that face us. Our major concern, though, is that that study and this bill doesn't really address the health of the providers in the field, but rather the health of the regulatory body. As you, I know that this committee has no control over it, but I'd like you to be aware that the pre-hospital providers in Oregon get reimbursed less than half the cost for transporting Medicaid patients, by, of which the state's responsible for payment of. And in addition to that, the state has removed any method of funding providers for uncompensated care. We used to have the Motor Vehicle Act that provided some compensation. So I think it's a two-prong approach, and this committee can't overshadow that one will solve the other. We are concerned somewhat that the NHTSA report indicated the failure of the Health Division, but at the same time, this bill tremendously increases the scope and reach of the Health Division and staffing. And while we don't necessarily have concerns with the specific issues, we do believe the bill is a work in progress, and we have to be careful of the fact that we don't create something that would then have to be funded later by the providers who are already suffering. The Oregon State Ambulance Association strongly supports the components of Senate Bill 162 that address the professional licensing organization, the Board of Emergency Medical Responders, and that it's a move that has been a long time coming to treat the people more as professionals and a more unified approach to their licensing and entry into the state. National Registry and bringing people in from other parts of the state to help solve staffing shortages has been difficult with the varying changes through the Health Division and various rule processes that have gone on. So we think Senate Bill 162, as proposed amended, does address some of those issues to help with some more consistency. We also strongly support the sections 39 to 46 that deal with strike teams. And our feeling on strike teams is the state isn't going to be the responder. It's the local responders who will respond. And the providers have been responding to disasters throughout Oregon on a voluntary basis. When there was a plane crash in Portland, the problem was not no responders. It was too many responders in an uncoordinated fashion. So there needs to be some coordination of that. But more importantly, to maintain the strength of the system, there needs to be the funding and liability release for those providers who do respond to it. And that's what we think that 162 does accomplish. With that, Sean Baird, one of our member organizations from Woodburn, has a few comments he'd like to add also. Thank you.
Thank you. Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Sean Baird. I'm a paramedic and own and operate an ambulance service, Woodburn Ambulance Service, and I chair the Area Trauma Advisory Board, too, for this region over to the coast, as well as I'm a member of the State EMS Committee. I would echo Ken's comments and point out that the amended version that's come out, we think, is making a lot of progress toward working with providers to solve some of the provider-level issues that weren't necessarily addressed in the NHTSA study at the front end, and we hope to look forward to continue to work with Dr. Higginson and his staff on further refining those as we go forward. And I guess that was probably about it. We covered it all.
I'll have to reiterate, I guess, what's already been mentioned. My name is Denise Giard. I'm the Emergency Medical Services Chief for the Albany Fire Department, past president for the Oregon Fire Medical Administrators Association, and a member of the State EMS Committee. Chair Berger, Chair Boone, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to address Senate Bill 162. And conceptually, I support the goal and the intent of the bill and to address the EMS system shortfalls. The lack of funding, the lack of support, decrease in staffing, and the performance deficiencies within the Oregon Department of EMS and Trauma Systems. As Dr. Higginson had mentioned, and I must give credit to the department for creating such a collaborative effort working on the solution and the recommendations from the NHTSA, a dedicated group of individuals representing public, private, tribal, volunteer EMS, the Air Ambulance, Department of Transportation, Oregon Department of Education, Oregon Rural Health, and I'm sure I'm missing a number of members, work very collectively and cooperatively to address some of those recommendations from the NHTSA group. Essentially, our system within Oregon is broken and has been for quite some time. Senate Bill 162 is a fairly comprehensive, as you can see before you, attempting to change the decades of the funding erosion, revolving door of the short-tenured leadership, poor planning, and a decline of the EMS system development. A comprehensive review of the system is necessary, and the changes are a must. As a paramedic and healthcare provider in the state of Oregon for 30 years, I believe the steady decline in the EMS and trauma systems has taken since 1977 is appalling. We are fortunate that the care delivered on a daily basis by the emergency medical technicians from each and every one of our agencies has not compromised the health care delivery within Oregon. It's our support that has been compromised. Senate Bill 162 is just the beginning of a long process to right the system, to chip away the prioritized recommendations and begin to assist Oregon EMS to be the system our citizens deserve and will desire. I encourage the committee to lend the support of this bill and make it a priority to begin rebuilding the quality EMS and trauma system. Lending your support and the encouragement of Senate Bill 162 will allow EMS and the trauma system and the representative stakeholders before you and many in the audience to continue the dialogue, to work out the details, and develop a working plan to address the many needs of our state EMS. I will entertain, and I'm sure we all are, any questions.
Senator Reed. I was going to say Senator Berger, and I'm looking right at you. Senator Morissette, sorry. And Senator Berger will be after you.
A couple of questions. First of all, my experience is in Lane County. I was mayor of Springfield for quite a while. We had FireMed. Do you guys have FireMed? Does that system exist in other parts of the state? It
yes.
does.
Okay. Yeah, actually, Mercy Flights was the first membership program in the United States that started. Okay. We started ours in 1949.
Good. Secondly, I'm under the impression that ambulances are in contact with the hospitals to find out if that's the right place to go. I know Eugene Springfield, the ambulances go either to Sacred Heart or to McKinsey Willamette and so on. Now, is that true in the other, well, the more rural areas where there are choices? Do you, before you take off, do you check to see if you're going to the right place?
Yes, Senator, except when you talk about the more rural areas of Oregon, there is only one hospital serving. So there's no options there. There may be referral from that hospital by air or critical care transport to other hospitals. But yes, the paramedics and EMTs work under physician control, and that physician and part of the process locally is to define which hospitals can handle which cases appropriately, and that's where we transport to. With the exception, patients have the right to refuse, and patient rights are still number one. So if the patient adamantly refuses and is aware of the risk, we will transport the patient where they want to go.
Just to follow up on the FireMed, is the FireMed still a viable system? Is it more or less viable? More or less?
Yes, I believe it doesn't make up the funding difference that it used to after Medicare and Medicaid fee schedules tremendously reduced the revenue from that. But it is still a valuable resource to the public, and it does help the agencies level out their funding. There is also legislation pending before this legislature that may affect some of those memberships that we're watching carefully, too. House Bill 2221 is one that somewhat concerns us that we're watching also.
Thank you.
Senator Bridger.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for Denise. Dr. Easton went down to the Katrina area from Ashland or Medford and helped out there, and she gave a presentation this week. One of her comments was that one of the reasons things went so wrong was that their system was weak to begin with when they got there. You've been there for a while, 30 years of experience, and your comment that things have not been right for a long time. And as an elected official, my question to you is, and I hope you'll give me a very sincere answer, and that is, have you, in the times that you knew it was not right, what have you done or what have others done in trying to correct what has been wrong? Now, I know Bill 162 has brought everybody together and you're trying to work through it so that things are better. But all of this time when things were wrong, have you been trying to get it better before 162?
Chair Verger and members of the committee, most definitely. The group of individuals before you and a number of others in the audience have been very actively involved with the activities of helping in attempts to rebuild the EMS division trauma system for a number of years. 5 years ago, we did a concerted effort to the attempts of revising the administrative rules that affected our operations. It was a 5-year project to get that with a collective and collaborative effort and assistance to the division. During that time, there were 3 different directors. So it is very hard to maintain the continuity of any attempt to address changes, to address, the initial NHTSA report from the 1990s, and then the follow-up report when there has been a revolving door of the leadership. The office has been unfunded, has had a lack of staffing, and I think representatives from organizations have been attempting to subsidize that with additional resources, additional brain power, if you will, to help that along. And we continue to participate at that venue.
I appreciate your candor. Thank you very much.
Rep. Schaffer.
Thank you. I appreciate what I like to hear from the people on the ground doing this work. And the more I hear about it, the more supportive I am of this. I just want to get this on the record because it's really important to me. In my Business and Labor Committee, we just passed out Senate Bill 400 yesterday, going to the floor. And I had a long, long list of managers and mayors and chiefs, police, fire, saying that they want to deny the collective bargaining unit the ability to discuss safety and management. And then here, and this is not lost on me, and it will be spread by me throughout this building, I hear right here on a fire department's letterhead the concerns about decrease in staffing. Now, we need to be talking about this, and I don't think we should deny rank-and-file members the ability to discuss it. And that's a different bill, but I just find this incredibly coincidental, and it's not lost on me, and it will be shared with a lot of very good people in this building. Thank you very much.
Senator George?
Thanks. When I read this bill, it scares the living daylights out of me. I've never seen such a concentration of power in my life. And when I put this together with some of the other plans that have come out of the governor's office, I don't want to give him any more power because it just seems like a tremendous grab for power. But you guys have just articulated the idea that we have a system that doesn't seem to be top-down to management savvy right now. Why would you want to concentrate more power in the central government of state management rather than allowing us to allow you to do your job?
I'll at least start with that answer, Senator. I'm sure all of us would have comments to that. Parts of the bill scare us, too. We're not supporting the bill as it stands. We're still working on its solution. My comments for the Oregon State Ambulance Association did address some of the concerns with the scope and reach of it, and the fact that it doesn't view the field responders' point of it doesn't address the field responders on it. The strike team's effect, though, that is significantly. It doesn't say the state's responding. It doesn't say the state's in charge of responding. What it's doing is saying that there's a system that allows for the reimbursement and legal protection of those of us who are responding already. That's the essential component of the strike team portion. The portion with regards to the professional licensing board, that is a provision for us having control of our own destiny. That authority already exists in the health division under the control of administrators that, as Denise pointed out, have been through a revolving door. That scares us. We want our own governing board to try and have some continuity. The rest of it, I think, is still a work in progress. I don't think we're necessarily changing our concerns over this. I guess it would be the best way to end it.
I think that pretty well summarizes where we're from there. A couple of points that I think we've reached some real clarity on: the Board of Emergency Responders, particularly in the amended version where the initial certification requirements are laid out in statute as opposed to being left in rule, is significant progress for us as provider agencies to have some continuity going forward in the strike team coordination efforts. We do have some concerns about other issues in the first couple of sections relating to the role of the different oversight committees and specific functions they'll look at, such as the county ASA assignment plans. We're hopeful we can continue to work out over the coming days with the section those issues.
Madam Chair,
before you start, okay. Senator George, Representative Nelson.
Okay. thank you, Madam Chair. I won't go into my remarks to the good doctor before you, because I think I know Mercy Flight. I know how you operate, so I can't even imagine that, you know, we're totally promoting this concept. But if we are public and private entities, is it because the term emergency, I'll go back to that, if we're talking about the term emergency meaning a huge hurricane, a tsunami, a big earthquake, then I can see why we need a plan for all of us to work together. But I cannot comprehend why we would want a state agency telling us how to run our businesses. You have your own board that would do that, and discipline and license, just like the contractors board and all these others.
If I might,
and first of all, I want to say Okay. Thank you very much for what y'all have done and will do and have always do.
If I might, Chair and Representative Nelson, on a slight point of clarification, the identifying of a STEMI unit or a cardiac specialized unit is just that. It's not necessarily to bypass a hospital just because you want to. It's actually identifying the medical facility that can best care for that patient in the more timely manner. Just like the trauma system, we have designated trauma hospitals, levels 1, 2, 3, and 4. In our local communities, we only may have in my community, we have a 2 and a 3 that I can respond to. So time frame-wise, we'd go. And in my community, I currently do transport to Corvallis Medical Center because they do have a cath lab. So it's an identified expertise in that specific patient care venue.
One follow-up. I still want to know if you think about it in terms of an emergency, a catastrophe in the state versus an ongoing program. But we talk about the programs in need for staff and for additional funding. I'm curious if that's why we're all building this again, because we need this other $2.5 million. But I'm aware of what we call the billfold biopsy, and despite all the good efforts to move people appropriately where they should go, there's this insurance card that's in their billfold, that's in their pocket, and we are directed to take that individual maybe to a, we used to call them county hospitals, I won't say that anymore, versus a trauma center. So we are directed by others, insurance, for example, how to run our business already, right? So why would we want another entity telling us how to run our business?
If I may, Madam Chair, I don't believe it's necessarily... I don't view the Health Division as coming in and telling me how to run my business. I do see their role as... I guess in simple terms, the equivalent of a truth in advertising, so that hospitals, medical departments, and ambulance services actually have to offer the service. They convince their public they're giving. Just because you have one cardiologist doesn't make you a heart hospital. If you don't have interventional catheterization capability that is open 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, you probably shouldn't be able to tell people that you are. And that's what the trauma system does. It didn't tell the hospitals what they had to do. They just had to meet a standard if they were going to tell the public that. And I think this accomplishes some of that. I'm an ex-farmer. I'm not necessarily in favor of government telling me how to run things. But if government is underfunded to meet its needs, then it delays the whole process. The Health Division being underfunded to certify EMTs and paramedics has kept us from being able to fill positions and therefore running without paramedics on ambulances in some cases. That's a problem to us.
Okay, and I'm going to take Senator George and then Representative Cowan, and then we're going to move to the next panel. So you can be brief if you need to.
Yeah, no? I'll be really brief.
Okay.
Madam Chair, this bill is so flawed. I mean, I think they need to go away and work on it, bring us back something that I wouldn't just be jumping up and down screaming about how outrageous, because all I look through here and I see adopt rules, conduct investigation, discipline, investigate. And I'm not seeing anything that I would say this is a real positive thing for making a system function in Oregon. And I know that that may be toned down, but whenever you grant that kind of authority to an agency to write rules, and particularly where you have an opportunity with 2 million or plus to build a really nice-sized bureaucracy, I'm sure that each one of you, when you go to renew your license, are going to be paying a substantially increased fee. So I would just suggest we send this thing off for work.
I think they are working on it, continuing to. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And with apologies, I don't think I can be brief.
Okay. You just say what you need to say.
First of all, I don't believe that this bill is fatally flawed, nor do I believe that it's a power grab. And let me just say that I think I have a little credibility in this conversation. I was an EMT and taught most of the classes that were taught in Northeast Oregon in the early 1980s. I am very proud to have been part of the EMS system when the 1990 report came out and said that we had an outstanding system in the state of Oregon. Now, like Dr. Higginson, I haven't been in this business for a number of years. I think probably my last ambulance run was in about 1990. So as a member of the Public Health Advisory Board, when I saw the report come out, the second report, it was more than hard for me to read. I was devastated that a system that I put a great deal of my life into building could have declined to that to the point that we're struggling with. And I argued with them, and I told them the report was wrong, and I spoke out for all of the individual providers out in the field who I believe, because of their heart and soul and the energy that they put into what they're doing, are providing wonderful care for people. I think that we need to get away from just focusing on the piece that talks about sending a patient to the appropriate care provider, because I'm very sensitive to the comments about sometimes there's only one hospital in any given area. This is not about telling private business where they must take someone that they need to transport. This is about emergency response in the field. This is about taking care of you and I when we have an accident or an illness somewhere in the great state of Oregon, and expecting a level of training and a standard of care to be pretty much the same, whether we have that car accident in Jordan Valley or if we have a heart attack in downtown Portland. And that's the oversight piece, the training and the standard, the level of standards that has been eroded because we haven't been putting the focus from the state level and the coordination that we this whole spectrum of emergency care deserves. And I think that this committee needs to look very carefully at this bill and think about what it is we're trying to do. We're trying to restore that competency from the state level that can work with our dedicated local providers and make sure that we're doing what the Oregonians, what Oregonians and the visitors to our state deserve. If the responders feel differently, I'm very anxious to hear from you, because I've said from the beginning that what I don't want to see happen in this process is that there be any adverse reaction or result for our local providers, because those are the ones that are doing the job. But I think that they really need the state help in providing a standard level of training and getting that training out to people. I don't want to ask my citizens. I was involved in Elgin. That's way up in the northeast corner of Oregon. I don't want to ask those people to have to go to Portland to get some training. I want us to take the training to them. The mobile training units, we've hardly noticed that was sort of buried in here, but that's a really important part of this bill. So I would just encourage us to look at the scope of what it is that we're trying to do here, and not real get real focused on our concern about what the state is trying to do. But I guess I'm really pleased to hear that you're interested in the Board of Emergency Responders, and I would insist that from the state level we continue to have a real cooperative effort and exchange between everybody that's involved with this field. But I think, and I just would like, I guess I'm getting my question now, I'd like confirmation from these providers and everybody else who's going to present to us today that they do in fact see some need for additional help with standardization of procedures and training and making sure that whether we're in rural Oregon or in metropolitan Oregon, we can expect and support both our volunteer and our professional, paid professional responders. Thank you.
Thank you. You were right.
Sorry, couldn't hold it.
Very good comments. Well, thank you all very much. Appreciate you making the trip today.
Thank you.
And our next panel is Ken Armstrong, Mark Stevens, and Andy Easton.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, Ken Armstrong. I'm here today representing the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association and also Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. With me is Mark Stevens from Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue as well. In the area of fire and life safety, virtually nothing is more important than having a strong EMS trauma system, both at the state level but also at the local level. And a lot of those issues have been hammered out here this afternoon. That's clear. The NHTSA report revealed a lot of problems that a lot of us had some real problems with. We had similar reactions to other members of this committee and similar reactions to people who have already testified before you this afternoon. Our feeling is, and I think it's clear, that this is still a work in progress. There is a bill with a bunch of hand-engrossed amendments that really aren't finalized yet. We continue to be in dialogue with the Health Division. We've got a number of people who have engaged directly with them and provided a number of comments, and I think we're not there yet, but I think we are drilling down, getting close, or at least closer to having a product. Clearly, we're not there yet, but I think we are making progress in that direction, and at the end of the day, I think we will probably see a product come before this committee that is more workable for all of the stakeholders. At least that's what our hope is. And so I'm here today to say we continue to work with Health Division on it. It's not perfect yet, far from it, but I think we are getting closer, and we are going to continue to do what we can to make that product right. And as I said, I have Mark Stevens from Tuolumne Valley Fire and Rescue if there are any specific questions. And Mark, if you want to add anything.
Hold on just 1 second, Senator Johnson.
Sure.
Thank you very much. Mr. Armstrong, in ideal circumstances, and that would take into account the session is on right now, how long do you think it would take for you all to continue to meet to deliver a product that you think is a ready for prime time product?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, you know, it's interesting. On this issue, it seems like every couple days somebody else comes up to me and says, hey, do you know what's going on with Senate Bill 162? We've got some concerns and issues. So the stakeholder group kind of keeps getting a little bit bigger all the time. But I think that the Health Division is doing the level best that they can to reach out and make sure that everybody is involved in the discussion. I think with some intensive work, in a matter of a couple of weeks, if everybody's schedules fit, we should be able to hammer something out. Is that too optimistic? Perhaps. I don't know, because we all have a lot of things on our plate. But I think it is reasonable to think that we can get there in enough time to have a product this session.
A couple of comments. Having recently been a consumer of EMS services, I can't think of any higher public service that is available to citizens. This is an essential service. While I don't live in the world that Representative Cowan, I'm looking right at you, and others who do this on a daily basis inhabit, and I don't know the vocabulary, and I can't just by reading the bill readily pick out the things that are problematic. It seems to me that the erosion of the status of EMS in Oregon is something that ought to bring shame to all of us, and we all ought to be sad about it and be cheering to try to fix it to the optimal degree that it can be fixed. What I'm leading up to is that we're trying this noble experiment this year of meeting again in January. And I know the exigencies that exist for all of us during the session and how difficult it is to make meetings and that sort of stuff. And at least I don't want us to get into the habit of punting forward into the next session. But commend for the chair's and the co-chair's consideration that this might be exactly such a product where you're close, the pressure of the session is here, you may not be able to get to closure. Sometimes the pressure of the session forces closure, but on something this important, I think we would all urge doing it right. And maybe this is the kind of bill that could be introduced here and carried forward into January, give you guys that much more time to continue to refine it and bring us a product that we can find bipartisan and bicameral support for.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, I think both my clients in this issue, Tuolumne Valley and OFCA, the fire chiefs, would absolutely agree that the worst thing we could do would be to develop a bad product at a session on an issue of this level of import. I mean, if that means we need to take more time to have a good product that does the right thing, that's what we need to do. So is that a possible scenario? Absolutely.
One more question. The fiscal with this, the intended source to fund the improvements and fund the bill is a cigarette tax. Is this a prospective tax or is this a piece off of an exist?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, my understanding is this is the new proposal for cigarette taxes that are in the governor's budget, but I'll defer to Dr. Higginson on that issue.
Okay, so this would be part of the money that would fund healthy kids and, okay.
I thought I heard you say the end of the day. Maybe it was a little.
Madam Co-Chair, I don't think I said the end of the day, but
perhaps I'm at the end of the day, one of those.
Oh, well, yes, I did. You're correct.
One other question. It has a $2 million fiscal as it currently rests, and I'm looking for Dr. Higginson to nod. Assuming that we had a wonderful system, it deteriorated. We're now rebuilding a wonderful system with a finite dollar amount on it. I'm just curious whether or not anyone has looked forward several biennia to see if there would be additional infusions of money, the state money, that would be needed to maintain a very high-quality product once we restore it. And if Dr. Higginson is a better person to pose the question to, I'll hold the question. I'm just curious, once we get it restored, what it'll take to keep it restored in terms of equipment, ongoing training, increased costs, inflation, all of the sorts of things that might cause us to lose ground again.
Well, I think that we'll... I'm going to have to move forward, but I think we'll be definitely looking at that. You want to comment on that? Or?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, I don't think I'd be equipped to answer that, so I defer to Dr. Higginson.
That's fine, Madam Co-Chair. I'll just leave that out there as a question.
Okay. And Senator George.
Thanks. I'm going to read from one of the testimonies here, and it appears to me that we probably have the solution right here, and it's called the state. Because here's what it says. The state currently only reimburses providers at one-half of the cost of providing the service to Medicaid-eligible patients and has no means of reimbursing pre-hospital providers for uncompensated care. I don't know what we could do for you any more than making sure that you get paid for the work you're currently doing, and I could see the outgrowth of that payment being a very much enhanced system. Nobody wants to comment. It's okay. I feel happy.
I'll defer to some of my more intelligent colleagues on those issues. So,
Mark, are you
just very short.
Okay.
Mark Stevens, Emergency Medical Services Chief at Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. Madam Chair and committee members, I echo what Representative Callan said. I originally came from Kansas. My wife is a born Oregonian, and I took one look at the state and came here. But now work in an urban system, so I've seen it from rural to urban, and I've seen nothing like this state in the collaborative efforts between its responders. And my frustration has been what Denise has shared earlier, that we'll try to get something done, and then we don't have the support of the state. And from the fire service, this is the first time the fire service first responders have stepped forward and said, we would like to be held to accountable to a standard of care also, because we want to participate as a state and guarantee that there's certain response standards that are out there. Right now it's done by individual agencies and counties and groups doing it from the heart. And this bill helps to give some of that structure for us and answer some of those questions and knock some hurdles down. So.
Andy?
Co-Chairs Boone and Berger and members of the committee, I'm Andy Easton, Director of Advocacy for the Oregon Hospital Association. We appreciate the work that DHS continues to do to improve Oregon's EMS and trauma systems. We do have some concerns, which we have shared with DHS, and we look forward to working with them and addressing those concerns. Senate Bill 127 is not finished, as we have heard today. It still needs some work, and it is our intention that we continue to work with DHS and others so that we can have a final product for you.
Do you mean 162?
Yes. Okay. Thank you, 162.
I want to clarify that.
It's been the same thing all day.
Yeah. thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
And our last person is Dr. John Dewey and Dr. Dean Dublin. All right. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Welcome back, I should
yeah.
say. You were just here.
Do you want to go first, Dean?
Yeah, you can rebut what I have to say.
No, that's fine.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I ask your indulgence. I'll read a short statement.
Could
but
you
I'd
give
like
your
to,
name, please?
Yes, Dr. Dean Gubler, Gubler. And I'd ask your indulgence that I spend just a second to introduce myself. Like I said, my name is Dr. Dean Gubler. I am a trauma surgeon and director of surgical critical care within Legacy Emanuel Hospital. I am board certified in general surgery, surgical critical care, and preventive medicine. I authored the current chapter for the resource document of the Committee of Trauma for the American College of Surgeons on disaster preparedness. My statement. The physicians responsible for care of the critical ill and injured cannot support Senate Bill 162 due to the nature of the recommendations for committee membership. This committee has recommended a process that does not uniformly represent members of the group of hospitals and physicians that provide trauma care as part of the Oregon State Trauma System. We believe that the process for drafting the bill was flawed, and that it failed to have adequate representation from physicians that care for critically ill and injured patients. The care provided by these physicians represents acute long-term responsibility for patient outcomes. Further, the ultimate recommendations for committee membership greatly underrepresent physicians, hospital staff, and hospital administrations responsible for the care of critically ill and injured patients. It unduly overrepresents pre-hospital care that is responsible for the short term, often less than 1 hour, in pre-hospital environment. Failure to support hospitals in disaster preparedness is best illustrated by failures in New Orleans during and following Katrina. Further, the failure of states to support hospitals has been recognized nationally by authorizing legislation, and it is not in my written statement, at the federal level, to fund hospitals directly for disaster preparedness. We strongly recommend this bill not be passed in its present form. I represent, and this isn't in my statement, I am the end of the road for the critically ill.
Thank you. Senator Johnson?
Thank you for your testimony, Doctor. Is the bill fatally flawed, or if there was a shift in the composition of folks giving input into the bill, could it be salvaged? Would you start with a blank piece of paper? Is it that bad?
No, it's not that bad. And I wouldn't want to have it be interpreted that it's that bad. Certainly, we are not at odds with the pre-hospital community. We recognize their needs and are very supportive of those needs. What we do not feel is fully appreciated is the importance of the input of the physicians who receive the patients and then are responsible for the ultimate outcome.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Right. So if the assignment from this panel was to go forth interested parties and continue to negotiate, if there was an accommodation made to include more physicians and trauma hospital input, would you be satisfied then that the process was in place that could try to work towards a better outcome?
We believe that'd be an improvement in the process, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Morissette?
My question was answered.
Okay. All right. Dr. Jerry?
Madam Chairs and members of the committee, my name is Dr. John Ju. I'm a practicing emergency physician at Oregon Health and Sciences University, and I am also the EMS medical director for Multnomah County, Oregon, and which includes the City of Portland, City of Gresham, and Port, as well as the chair of the state EMS committee. I'm going to make my comments fairly brief. I believe Senate Bill 162 is a good bill. However, I actually do agree with many of the comments that Dr. Gubler actually has regarding the hospital side. But let me sort of refocus the portions of the bill that actually we're really talking about. The first one, the most controversial, is the state makeup of the various committees, and basically what you're actually having in the state is three or four different silos. The EMS committee, which I chair, the EMSC committee, which is another chair, and the State Trauma Advisory Board. All those three committees really do not interface with each other effectively at this present time, and the effort by the State Health Department is to actually make those committees work together a little bit better and actually collaborate. The wording is not perfect, and I'm actually not happy with the wording completely myself. But the second portion of the bill is a very good portion. And that bill actually creates the Board of Emergency Medical Services. Historically, Oregon has led the nation underline, on the education and the professionalism of the EMTs and paramedics that are in the state. It has an associate's degree, and the community college has a great collaboration with the training and education, in particular the rural areas. Okay, and so I honestly think that Oregon should capitalize on that and continue its current momentum. And frankly, the associate's degree and the training of Oregon EMTs and paramedics is first class, like the trauma system was. And the third is a warning shot. The third is the disaster response of the state. The disaster response of the states, we're in deep trouble from a medical point of view. We do not have a system. That system, really, our fire defense colleagues have a system, and frankly, we need their help in creating that kind of response. So I would strongly urge you to look closely at the disaster portion of that bill and the Board of Emergency Medical Services, and the other portion probably needs to go back for some more work as well. Essentially, that's all my comments, and thank you for allowing me to speak.
Well, I appreciate your comments, and it makes me feel good having been a part of that system, and I'm sure Representative Cowan and Nelson would agree. And I appreciate your comments, too. It's just really good information for us, and this gives us a little back on this committee, too, on what we're trying to do here in the big picture. So, Rep. Nelson.
Thank you. I would be remiss not to say something really good about y'all. So I just want to thank you for being good and great doctors and for all those you've saved.
Okay, any further comments? Oh, Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, perhaps this is a question best directed to Dr. Higginson, but it might be useful for the panel to see a list of the people that were at the table during the development of 162. Simply so, Dr. Gubler has testified emphatically that there wasn't adequate representation for trauma doctors or hospital systems. And I would welcome seeing who was there. And also, I'd be interested in knowing who the appointing authority was. Did people self-select to come forward? Were they tapped in some official way? How far was the net thrown to gather expertise? It seems to me, just by credentials alone, there are two experts sitting in front of us, and it causes me to be curious about how the negotiating table for 162 was put together.
I can't answer that. Dr. Higginson can. But I was part of the NHTSA assessment team, and the trauma group was represented, as well as EMSC. However, honestly, they are as busy as I am, and there were a lot of meetings that they couldn't attend. And there was a non-optimal communications problem.
I can't give you the list. Yeah. I can tell you who wasn't on it.
No. Madam Chair, these two physicians were just targets of opportunity for me to ask a question. Dr. Gubler's testimony caused me to think about who was at the table, who wasn't, and who set the table. And as a result, I know that I will direct my question to Dr. Higginson.
Dr. Bob Reed, who's my colleague and the chair of the State Trauma Advisory Board, was on the assessment team, recommendation team. So there was a trauma representation on that board as well. But Dr. Gubler is absolutely correct, and I would actually have to side with him. The group was primarily EMS people. They were not primarily hospital people. And Dr. Gubler, I mean, I work in both camps, and I actually understand what he's actually trying to say. He works in a different world. So there was not as many hospital representatives in this group as there should have been.
One final comment, Madam Chair. If we're talking about a system, I would submit the system includes the hospital doors when they open and the patient is delivered into the hospital and into the trauma team there waiting for them.
We would agree. and actually all hospitals, including our pediatric colleagues, our stroke colleagues, mm-hmm. and our cardiac colleagues as well.
And our administrator will get that list for us. So
one second.
I have Senator Berger next.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that it begs the question for me as to exactly what is the state's role. we're looking at a system that needs to be set up so that the patient care is of the biggest concern, and we all fit into that picture. And I don't want it to be where the state is standing in the way. The state should be the one helping organize that makes it smoother, faster, better for the citizens of Oregon. And so I'd like for Dr. Higginson to respond to that, Madam Co-Chair, when he comes up about the membership of the group that put it together. Because I think we really need to understand what our goal here is. It is to raise the system, but I have to go with Senator Johnson on the fact that I, too, personally have had a lot of experience in recent times with EMTs and doctors and hospitals, and I have to tell you, I can't say enough. I couldn't say enough kudos and good things and appreciation and heartfelt, sincere thanks for the kind of treatment that you people give to people in crises. But I'm concerned that a system where people are involved trying to organize it, and this person shall do this. This committee will be composed of this. The governor will do this, or doesn't have to do any of it. It sounds too bureaucratic for me. And I think that we've got to realize to somehow squeeze the lemon juice out of that and really put something in first place, and that is the patient care.
If I could just write a comment, I would tend to agree with you completely. The analogy I like to give is the football coach. It's really the players that actually execute the play, but the coach is actually there to make sure that they have the right stuff. I've been in Oregon for over 30 years, and honestly, this state is amazing. I've never seen such volunteerism and professionalism by the providers. On the other hand, this is a bootstrap community. I know people in Northeast Oregon and the rural parts of Central Oregon are really on their own. And frankly, it's time that we actually make sure that we make a system rather than having them piecemeal their training and their access to health care. And the medical directors are, honestly, besides us in the Valley and parts of Central Oregon, we're paid. The rest of the doctors that are out there are volunteers. They don't get one dime for doing what they're doing as well. And that is what needs to be fixed. So training, education, and really the facilitation and the collaboration is what we're looking for. And I think the language is probably doesn't reflect that, as you appropriately picked up.
Senator, if I may make a brief comment, I believe this to be reflective of a larger struggle in this country about healthcare delivery. Mm-hmm. And the question I would ask the committee, do they want healthcare delivery led by the folks that deliver the healthcare, or do they want it led by other people? I'm here to argue that physicians ultimately should be the head of the team, and that they help put a team that functions very integrated in an integrated fashion to provide the highest level care, and that government should be supportive, not directive.
And Senator, I have Representative Nelson and then Senator Wilson.
Sure.
Thank you. I just want to say also I would not be here today had there not been some great emergency care on October 28th, and I'm so grateful, and thank you very much. And my real question is, do y'all already, Madam Chair,
go ahead.
Do y'all have in place already a disaster medical plan? Doctors, both.
Representative Nelson, we need to go through about four more bills.
But can we just ask them this question? Because I asked before, I think when you were gone, I asked Dr.
Okay. I think from the EMS portion in my locale, we do. Okay, but the problem is that a Richter 8 earthquake in Oregon, in Portland, will take us down as well, and we need the rest of the community to come out. But we actually are ready. Okay, we've been working for 10 years, okay? But the portion is that there's no glue that actually enables Corvallis, Eugene, Salem, Bend, or
Northeast Oregon to come in together for our aid right now.
So his, what he's telling you is when he gets that phone out, and he's the only guy in the room, by the way, who gets to have his cell phone on. Yeah. So if he opens it up, I'm jumping.
Okay.
The hospitals, you may want to comment on that.
There is no integrated hospital response for disaster, and unfortunately, disaster preparedness at the hospital level is one based on criteria set down with really no support on how to train people actually to develop plans, and there are no matrix existing for adequacy of preparedness, and hospitals are doing their best, but they're not prepared, and I wouldn't want you to believe they are.
I have to apologize to Ken. You actually have that permission too. Senator Morrison.
You know, the thing we have to keep in mind is that we're looking at the welfare of the patient, the care of the patient. I mean, the welfare of the patient. And turf battles and other kinds of things exist. And Ways and Means Committee, Subcommittee, we're hearing the budget of public health, and we're hammering on performance goals. How do you measure what you're doing and so on? And so we're giving some direction to them to set some parameters and to make sure that they're doing the right thing. And so I think that that's the job of the Department of Public Health, is patient safety. And I see that as the driving force here, and we need to have input from all of the providers. The doctors absolutely have to be included. But, and I'm sure, you know, you agree that the bottom line is the patient safety. And that's what I'm hearing. So we're giving direction to public health to tighten up, do the right thing, and I think they're doing it, and hopefully they're doing it in an inclusive manner.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. It's been very informative, and I know you'll be back. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 162, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2670. And, Jim, you want to tell us what happened at the work group.
Yes, ma'am. House Bill 267. We had a work group that met on March 7th. It was 10 of us. Representing Patty Smith was also there. There were amendments developed. The amendments would remove the emergency medical technicians and first responders, require 100 hours of volunteer service, and removes the word rural that was in the original bill, and would allow a tax credit up to $250 per year. The sunset provision that was in the original bill has remained. This bill has a subsequent referral to revenue. There were two people signed up to testify under the public hearing, but they have opted not to, so we can move the bill.
Okay. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2670, and I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2670. Is there a motion?
Madam Chair,
could you give us a little tiny bit of background, the deletions, what the history was?
Oh, okay.
It was what they had discussed was that the EMTs and the first responders were of a different category. They're already certified, and they would be better served to be moved over to House Bill 2500.
Thank you. I must have just missed that piece. Thank you.
There was a little disturbance.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to move House Bill 2670 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
We have to adopt the next amendment.
My goodness. Madam Chair, I move we adopt the dash ones to House Bill 2670.
Representative Nelson moves the dash one amendment. Are there any objections? And does everybody understand what happened, what we did?
No.
Jim, do you want to go ahead while we're discussing this, then just reiterate it, Representative Cannon?
Well, I guess my question follows Senator Johnson's, and perhaps I'm just a step behind. We have a different Bill 2500 that's going to have EMTs?
2500 is not in our committee. It's in a different committee.
But it proposes to adopt this, to grant that emergency responder the same tax credit?
It will be a different tax credit for the EMT and the first responder. This bill will now only deal with firefighters.
Did you hear the part about the work group? There was a work
group. I heard there was a work group. Unfortunately, I didn't have it on my agenda, and I don't have the rest of my file in front of me, so I'm flailing away here. I missed it. Okay.
I have the file. I don't understand why I had the file. But no.
We had sort of an emergent gathering of files as I came down here today, so I apologize for being unprepared.
You're not alone.
And I was not able to attend the work group on this bill, but this is what they did, and I was going to say, then I suppose Jim could explain again what happened, because I know there were a lot of people getting up and leaving when he was saying that.
I heard what he said.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, we have Representative Nelson has moved the -1 amendment. Are there any objections? Seeing none, and noting the objection, no objections, -1 amendment will be adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2670 as amended to the House floor with the due pass recommendation. We've got to go to revenue. Sorry. To the Revenue Committee first.
And Representative Nelson has moved House Bill 2670 to revenue with a due pass as amended. Is there any further discussion?
Only the Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
I forget the gentleman from Coos Bay, the volunteer.
Shiderman?
Yeah. He told me that there are 7,666 volunteer firefighters in Oregon.
Volunteer, yes.
Yeah, so there should be approximately a $2 million price tag. I just wanted to get that on the record. That's very rough math. If everyone eligible applies, and I just want to point that out.
Thank you. And I would like to declare a potential conflict of interest, as I have a family member who is a certified EMT. I'm that close to losing my certification, so I'm probably not going to be able to do this. But if I don't lose my certification, if I somehow can recertify within time, I will declare a potential conflict of interest. Okay. Is there any further discussion?
Only that
Senator Morissette,
that you did check the various expenditures that we can get rid of to pay for this, right?
I have a huge list. I took the book home over the weekend.
I'll vote yes, then.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, there's plenty of timber in the forest and water in the river and land to build on if we want to raise revenue in this state. And fish.
Okay, I think we're ready to have Mr. Jerry call the roll.
Senator George Ellen.
Aye.
Senator Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Krieger. Senator Morissette.
Aye.
Representative Shoffa.
Aye.
Representative Callan.
Aye.
Senator George D.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Boehner.
Aye.
Chair Boehner.
Aye.
Senator Berger.
Aye.
Did I get two votes? Chair Boehner. All right. House Bill 2670 has been adopted, and we need a carrier. We don't. We're going to revenue first. Thank you very much, committee. Okay. Our next bill, I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 570. And seeing no anybody here to speak on 570? No? All right, thank you. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 570, open up a work session on Senate Bill 570. Do I have a motion?
Madam Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 570 to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
As
amended.
We need to adopt the amendment.
Excuse me. Which Madam Chair, I move -1 into the -1 amendment from the Senate Bill 570.
Okay. Representative Schaffler has moved -1 amendments. Are there any objections? Okay. Seeing no objection,
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I just want to ask you a question. In the -1 amendments, the line that says this section does not impose liability on or expand liability of a person engaged in search and rescue operations. Could staff explain that to me a little bit more clearly?
What I would really like to do is refer you to your left, to Senator Larry George. This was his amendment, and I believe he could probably speak to it better than I could.
I'm just trying to figure out how we inoculate against liability.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. We sat down in a work group back in the back of the room and then up at my office immediately after the last meeting. One of the big issues that was brought up in this was whether or not we were creating a new liability on responders when they went out there, and if they actually did do something to help animals, would they be creating some kind of liability if for some reason they had to release the animal and they had to pick up a human being? And so the idea was is that what we didn't want to do is we wanted to encourage the agency to have a plan of action on how to deal with pets and animals during catastrophic events. However, we didn't want to put our responders in the position of assuming liability because of our actions, because we're trying to deal with the issues of these pets that may be stuck in the situation. So the language that was developed with legislative counsel was a clear statement that this section, which is the action section, does not impose liability or expand any liability of persons engaged in search and rescue operations, which is a blanket statement saying that this is a request to basically lay out a program, but nothing in what we're passing here puts on any additional liability on our search and rescue operations. That this is simply, we should have a plan of action, but we're not requiring anybody to do something that would expand liability. And based on some of the testimony we had, that was the acceptable language for that.
Thank you very much. The reason for my question was that I spent 4 quality hours in an airless room with Mr. Murphy last night talking about liability for search and rescue folks, and I was just, as we struggled with it, I was quite curious to see how a 2-line sentence absolved liability from people dealing with animals, and I was just trying to find instruction in these lines.
I think that's the answer to your prayers.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morsett.
Thank you very much. Senator George, that includes having to protect yourself by shooting the animal. Possibly, if you're attacked by a dog when you're trying to rescue people, and that to me would be the most common thing that can happen. Not an animal getting loose, but at least being attacked by one.
Only if we don't ban animals.
Madam Chair, if I could respond.
Madam Chair,
Senator Morsett, this is exactly the kind of situation we're in, or what happens if you have to release an animal after you've taken possession of an animal, try to save it, and all of a sudden you've got to save a human being, you've got to release that animal. What we don't want to do is in a situation where we have our search and rescue folks in a position where they have to make these decisions, we do not want them to assume any liability. We'd like to encourage them to try to look out for people's pets, but at the same time, we do not, under any circumstances, want to create a liability because we're encouraging them to do so. We don't want to put an additional burden on them to do so. And so we tried to... In the restructuring, if I could go back a little bit, restructuring of it, we sort of put at the beginning of the entire Section 3, which is the planning stage, we said emphasize the protection of human life, and then they shall consider these other things. But first and foremost, they shall always consider the emphasis and protection of human life, and then consider these other options for preserving pets. And then we made sure that they do not impose any liability or expand liability of a person engaged in search and rescue, and that's exactly what we're trying to get at, Senator Morsett, what you were talking about.
You have my vote.
Okay. Representative Schaffler has made a motion to adopt the -1 amendments. Are there any objections or further comments?
Oh, and Charlie will go.
Okay. Seeing none, -1 amendments are adopted, and...
Madam Chair, I move House Senate Bill 5784 as amended with a pass recommendation. Is it going to the floor or is it have a referral?
Nope, it's going to the Senate floor.
To the Senate floor?
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Schaffler has moved Senate Bill 570 to the Senate floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there any further discussion? If not, will the clerk please call the roll?
Senator George Allen?
Aye.
Senator Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Schaffler. Aye. Representative Callen. Aye. Representative Nelson. Aye.
Senator Murphy.
Aye.
Chair Moon.
Aye.
Okay, we have adopted Senate Bill 570, and I would need a carrier.
You paused the problem.
I guess that would be you, Mr. Larry George. Okay.
What's the problem?
You.
And, the bill.
And just to, I want to do this just really quick before we move on. We need to reassign a carrier for House Bill 2080-A, and that I have pre-asked Representative Cowan if she would be so kind to the House floor on Tuesday 3/20.
That's your reward.
Carrier. And we also need a carrier for Senate Bill 330, and that is...
It's going to be on the House side.
Senate Bill?
Yeah, it's already moved. It's come.
When is it going to be up?
We don't need it.
Oh, okay.
We just need a carrier.
We need a carrier for the House side for that one.
On 330.
On 330, yes.
Okay.
Senator, or excuse me, Representative, I'm sorry, Representative Nelson will carry.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Okay, I'm going to open up a public hearing on, finally, House Bill 2923. And we have our regular, usual suspect, Mr. Ken Murphy, Director of OEM. Welcome back.
Thank you.
It seems like I've seen more of you than I've seen of my family lately, but that's a good thing.
Co-Chair Boone and Verger and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ken Murphy, the Director of Emergency Management for the state, and I want to provide just some general information for this piece of the public hearing on House Bill 2923. You should have in your packet some handouts. The very first page is this wonderfully colored little chart. And let me deconflict that real quick for you. And first of all, I'll start in saying that this piece of legislation does have a fiscal. It's not in the governor's budget. I consider this, in somewhat of my comments to earlier on Senate Bill 162, this is part of an investment to try and strengthen our ability to do planning, mitigation, preparedness, response, recovery efforts across the state and especially regionally. The color chart represents my organization it is today. The colors represent where money comes from. And what I want to bring to your attention is you'll see that there are some stars primarily in the blue-colored blocks. And what my point is, those are the people that are really left, that are paid by a funding stream, that really can truly go out of our office or in our office and do all types of planning and help cities, counties, special districts, private industry, and citizens to the state of Oregon and other state agencies. Now, these other folks, even though they are funded by different streams, and I'll take two examples. The yellow, the 911 money. Those people are dedicated to making the 911 system work, keeping technology current, working with the 50 public safety answering points. The folks in green, the other example, they're located in eastern Oregon, totally dedicated to putting together the preparedness plan for two counties for the chemical stockpile emergency. So really, part of what you see here in this particular piece of legislation is to try and strengthen our ability to provide services out to the cities and counties. Just recently, as an example, which I'll take advantage of, is the landslide in Astoria that is continuing to slide. Having some of the people that's listed in this piece of legislation, if they're regionally based, could react to those things quicker, provide quicker help, and also do the many things that are needed to assist cities and counties. It doesn't stop us from doing things. We're working on that from our offices here in Salem and working closely with the leaders in the city of Astoria to deal with that. But this piece of legislation really is broken down into some very basic pieces. One addresses the real need to provide public education and outreach. We've talked about that in this committee in many circumstances. And that is a subject matter that fits everywhere. For us that spent the 4 hours in the airless room last night, that was even a discussion. Public education and outreach, even for search and rescue. Second piece is to define and help assist cities and counties with the issues of proper planning for special needs populations. Requires a lot of technical planning and assistance for all of the different groups in special needs. I wished I would have been quick enough on my feet. I have a list of those. It's a page and a half of different populations that require unique planning tools and specifics on how to deal with special populations. The other piece then is mitigation. To me, that's probably one of the more important ones. Those things that we can do with extra people and extra abilities, such as public education and outreach, to really mitigate against disasters. Tillamook County, the city of Tillamook, has been a great example of the things that we can do. I didn't get a chance to hand out. I handed out one to Representative Boone earlier, and Senator Johnson, I got one for you, but some posters and information about mitigation. And it's important because it gets us more money during a disaster when you have a prepared mitigation plan. The other one in this for these people that are asked for in here is to provide the leadership and coordination on a regional basis for long-term recovery and issues that we would have to deal with for small disaster, but clearly a big disaster. We've learned from testimony in this committee, Hurricane Katrina, many, many issues that go on long, long, long after the disaster that go with logistics and long-term recovery issues. And then really to reemphasize the importance of part of this plan is to put regional people. I have not been so presumptuous to say where they would go, but regional people out to help cities and counties. Again, last night it came up with search and rescue. Another issue with regional people is the ability for my office and working with the local cities and counties and other state agencies to create and implement incident management teams to help when a disaster hits and a community or a county is overwhelmed. So some of the rest of the handouts here, I think, are some basic information. I won't really take a lot of time in explaining any of this. I think I just want to give a brief overview, but you've heard me say before, today's preparations will determine tomorrow's outcomes, and this really stabilizes and increases Oregon Emergency Management ability to get closer to the communities, not be stuck here in Salem, and spend time working with them directly. And I'll leave it at that because I see questions.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator.
We're taking you out of the state police, right?
That's the intent with House Bill 2370.
But this, are you under the state? Is this under the state police? Is this out of the state police's budget?
No. As I mentioned earlier, it's not in the governor's budget, and I don't have any qualified answers as to where this money would come from. Something that we need to work on.
Okay.
Well, I guess let me start by saying I'm supportive of the concept of planning in your office. I would call colleagues your attention to the first or the farthest orange box to the left, George Kleinbaum. He was in the meeting last night. George really provides a remarkable service in this state. He coordinates all air search and rescue. I'm pleased to say I helped hire him 12 years ago. If something happened to George in this state, I'm not sure we could conduct an aerial search and rescue. And the point that I'm trying to make is we don't have a bench. There is, if George, God forbid, got hit by a bus tonight, there is nobody with his network of contacts, his relationship with the Air Force Rescue Center, his connections with the private sector volunteer searchers. I honestly don't think we could mount an air search if something happened to George. So the point is, this is a desperately underfunded agency. The question is, and the interesting position that Mr. Murphy is in, your boss didn't include the 1.8 in his budget. I would be very curious where General Reese, your potential new boss, is in this request. I'd be very curious where Superintendent McLean, your current boss, is in this request. And what this appears to be is a self-starter from the committee. Was this interim work that...
No. This came out of information gathered during committee hearings and following from the interim, following into this session.
But my curiosity is what your structure is going to look like, assuming that the bill that merges you into the military department is successful. What additional resources you'll have, what General Reese has in mind for an organizational chart, and to what degree any of that's been talked about. I'm sure every agency needs additional money, but I'm missing some really important pieces of sort of coordinating information as to what's your current boss, your future boss, what's the place going to look like after you move into the military department, and are you going to have additional assets at your disposal then?
Madam Co-Chairs and Senator Johnson, I have not talked to Superintendent McLean about this. I have General Reese is aware of this and is supportive. And at this point in time, the movement into the military structure, what you see in this chart, will not change. But I will have more resources that could be available depending upon the deployments of the National Guard or what's available. I have some far greater resources to draw from the military, but not necessarily the ones that I could just take away from General Reese or he would give me and place in communities regionally to do some of this work.
Follow up. The one other interesting thing that your presentation points out is, where are you renting at $700,000 a year?
Where you had the bad air last night. That's what it's costing to be in the Anderson Readiness Center.
I know that in the context of negotiating or working on the DAS budget and seeing what Department of Administrative Services charges other agencies, are you a thrall to the military department? Will this $700,000 disappear when you become part of that agency?
Madam Co-Chair,
I mean, that's
Senator
a lovely
Johnson.
Building, but $700,000? No. How many square feet do you have in that building?
The total building is over 117,000 square feet, but as tenants of the building, you know, we're charged a certain amount per square foot, and then common areas, we get charged a certain percentage of a common area. So,
Madam Chair, I would welcome a breakdown. I think this is excessive rent, and what we're really doing is passing money around among agencies behind the scenes. And I'm really quite curious whether the Anderson building becomes a profit center. How many square feet do you have?
I've got a little over 9,000.
$700,000 for 9,000 square feet. I got a giant problem with that.
Representative Southwick.
You know, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen 2 years ago came to me about a capital construction idea. All the rent we're paying. You know, we could go build some buildings, save a heap of money. And this is just one example, Senator.
No, we own his building.
Yeah, we own the building.
Well, okay, and we're paying ourselves rent.
Yeah.
It's even stranger than fiction.
$700,000 for 9,000 square feet. That must be some pretty snappy space.
That's right. That's I could be off a couple square feet, but it's I can get you the breakdown in detail. It's been an issue of controversy for us.
Have you tried to renegotiate?
Yes, ma'am.
Excuse me.
Who owns it? Who did? Senator Morissette?
Yeah, that's with DAS, right?
No.
Well, no. Co-chairs and Senator Morissette, I honestly, it's primarily a military facility, but DAS has a portion of it, and I have to get you some more detailed information.
Okay.
on it. But it's primarily a military department building.
Madam Senator Nelson, or Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, given the lateness of the hour and given that lack of critical piece of information, I'm not sure I'm prepared to move ahead with this bill.
This is its first public hearing, okay. So I just wanted to let you know. And are there any other questions?
Okay, well,
Madam Chair,
sorry.
I'm sorry.
I just have one question. You can think about it and get back to me at a later hearing. I'm sure you'll have to come back. But, you know, I don't see anything in the free airspace that you're allotted through public service announcements or newspapers or anything from your department. And I wonder if you might explain that. Why aren't you taking advantage of the freebies that are out there for you?
Senator Verger and Representative Boone, part of that is just simply there's not enough time in the day for me or my staff, and that's one of the pieces that I've testified during the emergency board to hire a crisis communications public education outreach. I've never had one. And so public affairs for us is as other duties as required. And I would take the blame for that. I just haven't had the time to go take advantage of the free things. And so you'll hear, and part of that, too, is we're asking in the governor's budget to have that position made permanent so that we can take advantage of those things and have the people. And I would just add and truly take advantage of Senator Johnson's comment, you know, that our bench is less than one deep in just about every case. And that public affairs piece with public education and outreach, working with the media, we've just never had anybody to do that, and so it's catch if you can, when you can.
Follow up?
Yeah, follow
one,
up.
One other quick thing. Who do you pay the rent money to?
That goes, Senator Verger, into a fund, and I think it does go through DAS to the military, but I'll have to get you the exact details.
All right. Thank you.
And we did hear Dr. Ju make the statement today that we were woefully underprepared and underfunded. And this is why I asked Ken very close to the bill drafting deadline to get some information to me we put into this bill to get this going. Because I think that it's important that he get funded in order to do all these things we're expecting them to do.
Yeah. And if I may, co-chairs Boone and Verger, just add, and this is surely not a plea for anything, but I think this committee has seen many of the pieces of legislation that has my name on it and the things that they are asking us to do. And so I think the unfortunate events of terrorism, Hurricane Katrina, and the other things keep, you know, adding to that to-do list. So, you know, this is really trying to take a look at, you know, how can we accomplish those things and do the things that we're supposed to do for the citizens of the state.
Madam Chair, one other quick question.
Now
that you're under the military, you mentioned the greater access to perhaps some funding. Is that Homeland Security funding, or is it?
Co-chairs Verger and Boone, Senator Moore said, not necessarily funding. Most of their funding comes from the federal government. But the resources, that I can obtain through the military, for an example, coordinating with General Reese and his staff, if I need assistance in putting together a logistics plan on long-term recovery, they have highly trained logisticians that could help me do that.
One other question. You wouldn't have to pay them, though, because you're part of their department, right?
I surely hope not.
Well, the way the money moves.
We have one more person signed up to testify. Thank you very much, Director Murphy. Jonathan? And I can't read the last name. It looks like it could be Chen. Okay. All right.
Yeah, I do.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2923 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2844. And committee, with your indulgence, we do have a couple people who drove over from the coast to testify on this bill, so he's getting the list. I see a familiar face. A couple of familiar faces.
Let's save time and bring up the whole group that signed up for the bill.
We have Paul.
Because I know he went out of here just as bad as I can remember how hard it is to sit here for this long.
We have Paul Claren, Hasina Squires, and Commissioner Terry Thompson. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Terry Thompson, the Lincoln County Commissioner. I'm here trying to deal with issues that you're going to face in the future up front today. And one of them is taxation of wave action generators that go into the ocean. And trying to figure out how we do it and how we deal with it. I think that these are corporate entities that will be placed into the ocean, and they should be granted the same rights as corporate would be on land. And that's the reason for this bill. It's to create a tax exemption for to extend economic development zones into the ocean so they could have tax exemptions the same as anybody can on land. Now, I think it's a good bill. I think it's the thing to do up front. And I'll let the other two people who are here testify because they have some small changes, and I'm willing to work any way to try to make a bill like this happen.
Madam Chair,
Senator Morrison,
a question to Terry. We had a discussion in this when I was in the Ways and Means Subcommittee last year about whether or not we're collecting any revenue from the state lands that go out into the ocean, and we're not collecting anything from that land. Now, you want to extend the enterprise zone out into the state lands?
That isn't necessarily true, and I'll explain to you why. A fishing vessel travels out onto the ocean. It's taxed in the harbor that it comes from.
Okay.
So a fishing vessel, if it stays inside of 3 miles, would be taxed at the full value of the state property tax. If it goes outside of 3 miles, it would be taxed at 20% of the value of the gear on board. I think this is one of the issues that we actually need to talk about, is exactly what it is. No matter whatever form of taxation that comes up, I think that the best way to get growth in an area is to give them this tax exemption and let them know up front now that they're eligible for it.
Okay. I guess what I was getting at is any resources that come from the state lands 3 miles out are not being taxed, the resources.
I'm not sure exactly what your question means.
Well, most state lands, we collect revenue on any resource value, but we're not. For instance, if they were, well, I guess the resources would be the crabs or the whatever comes from on that land, or any other economic interest that, for instance, if we were to put oil wells, I guess we would then change the law and collect revenue from the mineral resources or oil resources in the state land.
Of course, we pay a poundage fee on the product that goes to ODF&W. And we pay a property tax on the vessel that plies out there. So I wouldn't say that we don't get tax. It may not go to Department of State lands, but it definitely is taxation. That tax that goes on the vessel goes to the counties, and that's one of the reasons that I brought this bill forward, to make sure that these people will pay a tax when they get to where they're profitable. We don't want to stifle the growth, but we want to make sure that they will give some revenue to the counties of the port which they come from, the same as any fishing vessel.
Senator Johnson?
See the thought.
You're frowning.
I am. What did you just say about the port? I mean,
if we take a vessel from a port,
right,
we pay property tax,
right,
on the gear that's on the vessel,
right.
And if you don't go outside of 3 miles, you're taxed at one rate. If you go outside of 3 miles, you're taxed at another rate.
Okay, it was your terminology, the word port. You're talking about port in a generic term. Sitting next to somebody who's an advocate for special districts of various and sundry kinds. I was using port in a more specific term. You're using port, a place to go tie up a boat. Not the port of Garibaldi, the port of Astoria, the port of Brookings Harbor.
No, it goes as to that county that that port's in.
Answer
is yes.
Must be the 5 o'clock rule.
Oh, she can get me going because if she wants to be specific to me, port starboard is the proper term for port.
Let's not go there.
Don't go there. Yeah.
So that's the end deal, and I'm more than happy to work. I think it's an issue we need to start working with in the state and get this addressed up front, because as this industry develops, it always helps that an industry knows how they're going to be handled up front. So that's the reason.
Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, as the co-chair knows very well, there is right now an Oregon Solutions project that has just been designated by the governor, and I believe that Senator Verger is one of the conveners. Having watched Oregon Solutions projects unfold previously, it is always my desire that for one of these projects there emerges as one of the outcomes a template, and that that template has applicability to other places. The Oregon Solutions process is a process that identifies a problem, puts people together to figure out what the solution to the problem is, and frequently there is a lasting outcome that is instruction how to wrestle with this problem, whatever it is, as it manifests itself in other locations. I think that the work that's going to come out of the Gardner-Reedsport Wave Energy Oregon Solution Project could be instructive for how we deal with lots of these issues. What this feels like, and while I don't disagree with the premise of the bill, it feels like we're putting together one-off solutions without sort of identifying what are the whole range of problems or opportunities that could exist from the development of wave energy. I'm very enthusiastic about the outcome of the wave energy inquiry that's taking place in Reedsport, and I don't know if it will discuss this kind of detail. What I'm trying to avoid is every coastal county treating the development of wave energy in a different way, and I think you're speaking to all coastal counties would be able to apply under this enterprise. But I was just looking for instruction whether or not anything would flow out of the Oregon Solution process that might say that this is the way that we ought to treat this, by giving tax incentives for the development of wave energy, because that's really what we're talking about here.
So far, Oregon Solutions process has not talked to Lincoln County. They've only talked to one county, and that's Douglas County.
Okay.
And that's one of the things that's disheartening about this. They haven't even addressed a lot of the issues that Lincoln County has, even in Douglas County. Our fishing fleet goes down there, and I haven't seen them make any contact with any of our fishing fleets or any of the other counties.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Commissioner Thompson, I respectfully differ. The fishermen are at the table.
Actually, I don't know how they could be at the table from our port, because there may be people from our port there, but I don't see how. We have a new group that's called Fine Fishermen Involved in Natural Energy, and several of those fishermen travel from Newport and fish off Reedsport, and to my knowledge, they haven't made any contact with any formal group from our port.
Well, it could be that your application into FERC for wave energy has, is this a group that's working with you on that?
It's a group that was formed recently to try to get involved in this on a overall fisheries basis.
Well, we're going to meet again Tuesday. I'd be very happy to bring up the fact that you have a new group. You know, we've been meeting before. And so if you have a relatively new group, there are 6 applications in. Wave energy has become very competitive in a way. The wave energy group that I'm working with is focused strictly on Douglas County, strictly on a pilot project. We're really not looking at anything coast-wide. So they haven't been talking to Coos County either. So I don't think that you should be offended at all that they haven't included a new group from Lincoln County.
Fishermen travel up and down the coast, and it's concerned me that there has been very little addressing of fisheries issues
on a coastwide basis. They have addressed the issue down there, and several fishermen from Newport have gone down, and we're more than happy to work with them. But Oregon Solutions hasn't had any contact, to my knowledge, with Lincoln County or any of the other counties.
I don't think the Oregon Solutions team has been requested to pursue a coastwide effort. They are strictly there for the pilot project. It isn't a coastwide request from the governor's office.
I understand, and I don't have a problem with what they're doing, but this is a discussion we need to have because the fishermen off of Newport are impacted by what goes on in Douglas County.
I'm aware we're going to lose Rep. Schaffler here. So
I want to hear the bill, Madam Chair. I'm fascinated with this conversation, and I'm concerned about it. But
and Rep. Cowan, did you have a comment?
Well, yes, thank you. I think that we're kind of rolling several conversations into one here, and we're going to need to decide whether we need to come back and have it in a different venue. I understand Senator Johnson's point and the hopes that an Oregon Solutions project develops a template for other areas. I think the questions are different in what we're doing, and I don't think there's much hope of that happening for this question. Let me just simply offer the summary of my understanding of what this specific bill is getting at. From I think everyone up and down the coast is trying to deal with the questions that are emerging as a result of the wave energy exploration. And the hope of Lincoln County is that we can get a degree of local control around how this process develops for each of our sections of the coastline, be that the Douglas County coastline, the Clatsop County coastline, or whatever. And there's a concentrated effort in Lincoln County to pull it together in kind of a cohesive and comprehensive manner. And one of the pieces of that is because the county would like to designate the areas where these wave energy parks are sited in order that everybody's at the table for locating the sites. They'd like to design them around the concept of enterprise zones so that they, when they come up with a wave energy ready park or green spot for it to go, they can then encourage the investment of private enterprise through what can be offered via the enterprise zone structure that we have on land. And that's what this bill is about, I think. And I will grant you that Terry knows a lot more about it. I was just trying to focus the conversation back on House Bill 2844 and not the global picture.
Thank you, and I apologize. It's you're exactly 100% right on what the bill wants to accomplish. So I'll turn it over.
Could somebody make that was on the
record. I want to make sure that Senator Berger's got her questions with and her message to Commissioner Thompson.
I have. I believe that I understand what he's saying.
We have, you know, just as an aside, we've had an additional issue with one of the Oregon Solutions projects that I'm on, and these are it's a different kind of process, and some people pop in and out of it, you know, in the meetings and things, and it's a very tight process. And I think what she's trying to say is that they're doing that their process, and it's usually framed around one project or one issue that
very much
so. And Senator Johnson has working on one in Tillamook County, and mine is kind of statewide. But I don't think it's a well known process for some people, so that might help. So. Anyway, Hasina, are you next?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. I just have two comments. We support the bill, but we would like to see at least one amendment made to it. Page 1, lines 23 and 24. There's some language in there that says a proposed area would qualify for E-zone designation without regard to any applicable numerical limitation on enterprise zones. We'd like to see that this new type of zone fall within the existing E-zone statute and the existing limitation on the number of E-zones that are currently available statewide. Some of the E-zones actually aren't being used in the state. You authorized 10 additional ones last legislative session, so we think that there's an adequate number.
Okay.
Yeah, I remember that bill quite well. How many zones are we not using?
You know, Madam Chair, Representative Shockwell, I knew you were going to ask me that question when you said it.
Okay.
I don't
you can
have
come
it.
Back.
I will get it for you. And then the other, just a comment on page 2, the way this mechanism works is it requires the amount to be exempt from taxation. I'm looking at page 2, lines 12 through 18. It requires the governing body to set forth in a resolution how much would be exempt, and I'd just like to hear a little bit from our county assessors on exactly how that would work and how those numbers would be derived by the governing body and the agency. And in lieu of that, then it's $100 million. And I'm not sure if that's something that Representative Thompson, Commissioner Thompson, requested in the bill or how that works, but it just would be illustrative for us if we could hear from the assessors on how they would implement that if that were the case.
Okay. And may I please? And I'm supportive of the bill, too. I really want this to happen. And for the purposes of just wave energy, could we make the entire coast one zone? Or is that not possible?
They did that up in Astoria, didn't they?
That's kind of where I was was probing with the Oregon Solutions, just to see if that's instructive. If it were one giant zone, I understand that kind of negates where Representative Cowan was going with respect to local control. I would say that Lincoln County is by far ahead of some of the other counties in terms of thinking through these issues. But it seems to me that if we're going to serve Oregonians, do we not serve them by looking at a coastal enterprise zone for the specific purpose of wave energy development? And then we don't have companies coming in and playing one county off against another, trying to sweeten the E-zone pot, trying to broker deals and really pitting our local governments against each other as they have done, companies coming in looking for packages of inducements, have done magnificently in jurisdictions in Oregon. I think Representative Schaffler's on to something.
We probably need to, Madam Chair, we probably need to hear from DLCD though first.
Yes, we do. If you're ready.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Verger, and members of the committee. We only have...
Could you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm Paul Claren, DLCD, the Oregon Coastal Management Program. And our concerns run to Section 3.3c of the bill, which asks the director of OECDD to determine the consistency of that designation with the territorial sea plan. And currently, the Territorial Sea Plan does not contemplate this type of facility or this type of zone. So to determine consistency would be very difficult. And essentially, it would run the process through the Ocean Policy Advisory Council, and it may be far more complicated and deliberate a process than the applicant may be assuming. So what we would like to do is make it clear that this implicates a whole process for our agency to possibly amend the territorial sea plan so that these zones are consistent, or remove that. And I've detailed that analysis in the comments that I have written. So if you could just take a look at that. We're very supportive of the concept. We think wave energy is the wave of the future. Work with whatever agencies are dealing with it. And, of course, there is a lot of work already going on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Question? Senator Johnson.
I'm curious, and I think you allude to it in your memorandum. OECDD's expertise in doing this will probably default to you.
Precisely.
Yeah. All the more rationale for Representative Schaffler's idea du jour.
Stranger things have happened.
Representative
Cowan?
I think there'd probably be a real pushback on that many wave energy projects. The way that the discussions are going now is on how you're going to be able to limit the number of projects because of the impact on the fishing industry. They would be, I think the fishing industry and the crabbing industry would be just alarmed to think that we had an entire coast. What Lincoln County has talked about, and I think rightly so, if you were going to look at the full coast, you might not have chosen Gardner as the perfect place because it does have some fishing impacts. And Lincoln County has said that there are other areas in their county that might be better suited that wouldn't fully impact fishing. And I think that's an area that really needs to be looked at. We could get along with the Gardner Project and find that the electromagnetic field off of Gardner is not going to work where it might work okay in another location. But I don't think that we would ever be able to do a coastal, entire coast.
Ms. Cowan, Rep. Cowan, did you have a comment?
I did. A couple of things that I think need to happen. I think that we need to ask Terry to take the DLCD comments back to Lincoln County and review that with the rest of the commissioners and with Rob Bovet and Wayne Belmont, who have been kind of leading this project. And perhaps also before we debate it kind of endlessly, ask them to weigh in on the concept of a broader coastal area enterprise zone. And I'm not the expert on this, but generically what I'm thinking about in line with Senator Berger is that I think if we get the appropriate pieces in place to examine the sea and the uses of the sea, we will develop a plan for the most appropriate areas to site whatever wave energy farms we have. Right now we're in the experimental stage. We're trying to figure out if the things are even going to work and how they're going to work. But we really need to be out front of the development of this alternative energy project so that we do it correctly and get, if it is the wave of the future. If it is the direction that we need to move in a new form of alternate energy, then we need to be very careful that we site it appropriately. And I think we're all looking for vehicles that will help us in that process. So I really would like to have Terry have an opportunity to bring the rest of the brains to the table that have been kind of tossing and have them toss around some of the questions that have come up here. Unfortunately, Rob Bovet was unable to be here today because of a memorial service. So I think there's more to talk about if Terry agrees.
First, can I make one comment?
And, go ahead.
And that's at the Douglas County project. I sure wouldn't say that wasn't the best location, but I think it probably is about as good a location as we could have got to start. I don't want to have anybody go on record that Lincoln County is in any way opposed to that location. And
I
just wanted to clarify that.
I hope you're right.
Absolutely.
I was not implying that. I just think that Lincoln County has pointed out that there may be some better locations than others.
Right.
You didn't have anything to do with the Douglas County selection.
And I want to clarify the record, too. I'm certainly not suggesting a whole coastal zone with the idea of unlimited proliferation.
No,
in fact, quite the contrary. I'm making a case, knowing as little as I know about it right now, that a complete coastal zone would have a uniform application of benefits available to companies wanting to come into Oregon, and we could control the number of places so that where there were wave energy facilities, and we wouldn't find cash-starved counties competing against each other to perhaps site wave energy farms in places that they shouldn't go by increased tax incentives. I'm saying if we had a statewide, and again, this is without doing a lot of research on it, that way you could control the proliferation, you could control the competition, you could have all the counties feel as though they got a square shot at it without trying to wedge wave farms into places that they appropriately should not go.
I agree. I mean, we're all on the same page. I think we're trying to go forward. I'll take these comments back. I'll try to take your comments back because there really wasn't a way to address this issue. To my knowledge, there wasn't any negative, and I still don't think there's a negative to it. It's just a matter of working out the details. I had to take a rough draft at the best shot I could. I think it's still probably a good bill to move forward, but let's try to work this out and make it positive.
Okay, and with that, I'll close the hearing on 2844, and if there's no further business before the committee, we'll stand adjourned. Are you in the